talking on all political subjects and taking on all callers, this is Matt Flynn Direct with your host, Matt Flynn.
Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long.
Welcome back to the second hour of Matt Flynn Direct, coming to you statewide on Civic Radio from Madison, Waukesha, Wausau, and Wisconsin Rapids. Our lines are open, 844-967-2789. No subject is off limits. All points of view are welcome. Remember, you're not woke if you don't know history. You're not woke unless and until you know history. We're going right back to the front lines of history in the making. A signature bill signed by Joe Biden. Debt relief, student loan debt relief. It's been all over the news yesterday. I'm going to give you a little more detail and also my take on it. It can be debt relief for about 43 million people. 43 million people, that's a lot of people. The average person who qualifies is going to get $10,000 of loan forgiveness. You have to have made less than 125 grand a year or 250 grand a year if a married couple are both looking at it. If you received a Pell Grant while you were in school, you're going to get $20,000 of relief. That's because to qualify for a Pell Grant, you have to show extreme need, frankly, poverty. And the odds of you suddenly becoming super wealthy after that are slim to none that quickly. But in any event, if you did, good for you, but then you'll make more than 125 grand a year, you won't qualify anyway. So 10 grand a year for folks making less than 125,000, 20 grand if you had a Pell Grant. Now, with a lot of this money, this is going to cost over the next 10 years about $500 billion. I think it's long overdue. Folks say on the left say it's not enough. Folks on the right say, well, folks on the right, quite frankly, discourage people from getting a higher education. And they look on higher education as utilitarian, as only job oriented. And that's not what an education is about. There are some things, for instance, nursing. You can study medicine. You can go to MATC and get an excellent, excellent education and the trades and so forth. And that's fine. It's all well and good. But there's nothing like an educated citizenry with a broad liberal education to preserve our democracy. But I'm going to give you my take on this because a lot of talk about it. I think on balance it was the right thing to do, the right thing to do. But is there a deeper change that should be made? And the answer is yes. And I'm going to throw it out. I've said this before. At one time in the early 1960s, you know what the tuition was at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for a semester? About $100. I was in law school there in the early 1970s. My tuition was $250 a semester. Why was that possible? That was possible because the state of Wisconsin, when I was there, paid about 47 or 8% of the operating costs of the University of Wisconsin system. Now they pay about 17%. University of Colorado, they pay about 5%. They're essentially making these universities quasi-private, and they have to come up with revenue. And the only way they can come up with revenue is to increase tuition. And when they increase tuition, nobody can afford it. So what you do is you borrow, and then you're saddled with a lot of loans. And then the right wing says, well, education isn't worth it. Remember, Scott Walker said that the mission statement of the University of Wisconsin should be changed from the Wisconsin idea, which is the boundaries of the University of Wisconsin or the boundaries of the state. It was deep in our culture, and you get a terrific education in every university in the UW system. Every university. And my advice is get a good, strong liberal arts education, go for 4 years, study history, study English, literature, and you can study, if you want, nursing, You can go pre-med. You can study electrical engineering, other kinds of engineering, all good. But come out of it as an educated citizen. That's what Thomas Jefferson said. Cardinal Newman, one of the great luminaries of the 19th century, said the same thing about the value of a liberal education. Now, how are we going to accomplish this? Where is the money going to come from? Most of the money, by the way, quite a bit of the money, is going to for-profit colleges, so to speak, who basically provide internet services, and they suck up a lot of this, and I think that's got to stop. I think what we've got to do is pass laws that say that we are not going to subsidize your loan or lend you money or guarantee your loans from a for-profit. It's not worth it. In Wisconsin, if you want a good education and you don't go to go to UWM, go to Oshkosh, Eau Claire, La Crosse, Stevens Point, Whitewater, Stout, you're going to get a great education, a great education. And two other things, these nonprofits should stop being permitted to use state names in their titles and calling themselves universities. They're not universities. Universities go back to the Sorbonne and Oxford in the 13th century. The first real university was Plato teaching Aristotle. And Aristotle, by the way, then in turn, you know who his pupil was? Alexander the Great. That was a university, very small university, but unparalleled people. So, you know, right now there's nothing to prevent some for-profit calling themselves the University of Northeastern Wisconsin. And they go, oh, I'm going to get a degree from the University of Northeastern Wisconsin. I'm going to go online. I may hit every course. I may not. You get an exam, you take it, and no. Stop wasting our money on that stuff. You want a great education? Go to Madison, UWM, Eau Claire, La Crosse, Green Bay, Whitewater, Oshkosh, Stout, all these places, every other one, Superior, even ones I haven't named. Get a good education, 4 years. And if you want education in technical subjects, go to MATC in Milwaukee or the technical colleges around the state. You're going to get the best. And there won't be the need for any loan forgiveness because the state and the federal government should pay the majority of the operating costs of these places. And once again, we should have tuitions in the hundreds of dollars, not the tens of thousands. We're going to the lines. Dan of Madison, my friend, thanks for calling. What's your mind today, Dan?
Good morning, Matt. Here's an idea to, you know, maybe put forward out there, make a talking point out of. But I keep hearing how a lot of politicians are saying, you know, when I went to college, I was able to afford my tuition working 6 weeks at minimum wage. You know, we already have tuition caps. Why don't we just earmark the cap to minimum wage and say, just put it plainly, you know, tuition cap has to be no more than 6 weeks of full-time work at minimum wage. Then we can hit the problem in multiple directions.
Great.
You can increase the minimum wage, which will allow you to increase tuition, or you can sponsor, you know, you can pay more in the public portion of the university. But I mean, either way, there's a clear line and it's tagged to the economy.
I really like that. And you know why I like that? Because the minimum wage right now is what, $7 or $8 an hour. Effectively, most people are paying $15 an hour just basically to get staff. But even if it were $15 an hour in a 40-hour week, what is that, $600 a week? You have 40 times 15. And then 6 weeks is, it'll be $3,600 roughly. Yeah, and that's 15 an hour. If you cut that in half, it would be 1,750. And you say, great, you want it to go up? Raise the minimum wage. I love that. And the way I love it is because it's a way, it's a very clever and smart way of marketing it. Because what you're really saying is that whether they pay a tuition of $1,750 or $3,500, people should be able to afford that if they take a part-time job. But what it would also say is that it still costs a lot of money to run a university. That means the state and the federal government has to step up and pay a lot higher percentage of their operating costs. I like that. Dan of Madison, that is going to be attributed to you, Dan of Madison. Index it, peg it to the minimum wage, 6 weeks of minimum wage over the summer for your tuition. And if you want to raise the minimum wage, go ahead. But between us, no matter how much they raise it, it's still going to be a fraction of what they're paying now. And that means the federal government has to step in. I think that is terrific, terrific idea. Thanks a lot, Dan, for calling. I appreciate it. I appreciate it. Well, we've been talking about Ron DeSantis. Ron DeSantis is not only does not smile, he speaks violently. You know what he said yesterday? He's talking about Dr. Fauci. I like Dr. Fauci a lot. He said, quote, somebody needs to chuck that little elf across the Potomac. Quote, Ron DeSantis on Dr. Fauci. Quote, somebody needs to chuck that little elf across the Potomac, end quote. That's a violent thing to say. If you throw a human being any kind of distance, they'll break their neck. This guy's over 80. That is, you know, he thinks it's funny. That is a suggestion of violence. And that has permeated the Republican Party. And this guy is the nominee. Forget the fact that he doesn't smile. Nobody, Eisenhower wouldn't have said that. Reagan wouldn't have said that. Nobody decent would have said that. Nixon wouldn't have said that. Quote, somebody needs to chuck that little elf across the Potomac, end quote. That's violent. It's violent. Somebody at the highest levels of the Republican Party has to say that is violent. Shut up, knock it off. I'm saying it, but I'm not in the Republican Party. And you are not going to get any Republican senator or anybody else who will say it. At some point, somebody besides Liz Cheney and somebody besides Adam Kinzinger has to stand up and say this. Trump talks violent. He encourages violence. There was violence on January 6th. That's because it's seeping down from the big shots. But one of the big shots goes, quote, somebody needs to chuck that little elf across the Potomac, end quote, about Dr. Fauci. Enough's enough. We're going to a break. The lines are alive. I can see that you're on the line. Do not hang up. I'll get back to you right after the break. Mandatory break. Lines are open, 844-967-2789. A lot more back after the break.
Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell them that God's gonna cut you down.
Welcome back to Matt Flynn Direct. Lines are open, 844-967-2789. We're going right to the lines in order. Do not hang up. Starting with Bill of Shorewood, my friend. Thanks for calling. What's in your mind today, Bill of Shorewood?
Hey, Matt, I'd like to point out a few things about Social Security. First of all, Charles Ponzi did not issue an annual report. Social Security does. It can be found at ssa.gov. All the data is there, and a description of how the program works is there. Senator Johnson apparently has not read or understood how it works because it's a pay-as-you-go system. That means current workers are paying for current retirees. Plus, there's a bond fund, often called a trust fund, which was payroll taxes paid by the baby boomers to build up a bond fund so that the burden on current workers would be a bit less. But the main point to realize is that when people say that we should invest in the stock market and so forth, they overlook the fact that there is no money there. The money goes immediately out to current retirees. If you wanted to invest in the stock market, some generation of Americans would have to pay in without getting any benefits so that a fund could be built up in the stock market. The best way to get a grasp on this is something that Franklin Roosevelt said, and I quote, We put those payroll contributions there to give the contributors a legal, moral, and political right to collect their pensions and their unemployment benefits. With those taxes in there, no damn politician can ever scrap my Social Security program. I think that says it pretty well. Thank you, Matt.
That is excellent, Bill. Thank you. It's great to hear from a professional economist, which I assume is what we're hearing. And word to everybody, Ron Johnson says it should be discretionary. He would take the money and make it into tax cuts. Robert of West Allis, my friend. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind today, Robert?
Hi. I hate to correct the last caller, but if you remember in the 80s and 90s and in the prior time period, there was a surplus in Social Security in some of these programs, and Congress got their hands on it, basically borrowed from those funds and put IOUs in place of them that, oh, we'll pay it back later. If you remember when Al Gore was running, he was talking about a lockbox, meaning it was something they couldn't touch. But that wasn't the purpose of my call today. The purpose of my call was to talk about the student loan forgiveness program. I'm not sure that this is, the windfall and the great thing that everyone thinks it is. You know, as someone who's borrowed money and had to pay all of it back, if you bring up this point, you know, you get this immediate response from people like, oh, what are you, a ghoul? You know, you don't want the other people to get ahead. I don't think it's a jealousy thing or a zero-sum game. I think there's a difference between the generations here. You know, even if we go back to Clinton's era, they had things like the Lifetime Learning Credit and the Hope Scholarship and stuff like that. But it was all about lending a hand up. So rather than just wipe it out, I would have preferred them to put interest rate caps on it or start making, you know, community college or a trade technical school free so that it gives people a leg up. The problem I have with the system is it doesn't ask anything of the borrowers. And, you know, yes, we can say, the Republicans weren't asked anything as PPP. We know members of Congress got like $3 million in loans forgiven under that program. But, you know, just like a budget is a moral document, I think when we roll out a program, we should be asking these people to do something, whether it's public service in their community, their church, their local areas. The government has public service loan forgiveness, but I'm talking about these other borrowers. There should have been some kind of incentive for them to give something back to society, not just like, here you go, and we move on.
Well, a couple of things, Robert. Let me respond while we still have time in this segment. On your thing on Social Security, I don't think what you said about Al Gore and the lockbox, that was a political statement, refutes anything that Bill of Shore would said. I'll tell you why. When the money comes in, Bill pointed out that the baby boomer generation and all future generations are going to be putting in some money from payroll taxes and otherwise it goes into a bond fund. Well, the bonds are treasuries. They're U.S. treasuries. So their indebtedness of the U.S. Treasury to the people who hold those treasuries. You know, the Chinese right now hold about $1 trillion in our treasuries. Well, Social Security Trust Fund is going to hold treasuries. Those are bonds from the government. Now, cash goes in for that. And what Al Gore was trying to say was, well, we are not going to what? Use that money. As a practical matter, that money is used. And when treasuries are redeemed, there's money to pay for it. We, right now, generate a budget deficit. Budget deficits are lower under Democrats than under Republicans. That's just a flat-out statement. Under Bill Clinton in his last term, we had a deficit of zero. We had a budget deficit of zero. I'm not talking about the national debt. That's a separate thing. But the budget deficit for that year was zero. In fact, it was a surplus. And the Wall Street Journal put in an editorial saying that was a bad thing. You have to generate some debt so that you can issue treasuries and so forth. They never, ever, ever are consistent on the right. If a Democrat balances the budget, that's bad. If he doesn't, that's bad. Donald Trump added $7 trillion to our national debt. He went from $21 trillion and put it up to $28. That's the accumulation of past deficits. So in this particular case, I think that Bill is exactly right. And when it comes to student loans, we go into a mandatory break. So I've got to go to a break, but I'm going to respond because you raise a profound question and I want to address it. Lines are open, 844-967-2789. A lot more back after the break. Matt Flynn, director. Lines are open, 844-967-2789. Before we go to the lines, I'm just going to respond further to Robert of West Allis. Always enjoy his calls. But in this particular case, I think that Joe Biden did the right thing in the student loan forgiveness. And I do not think that people should have been asked to do what? 44 million people are going to do what? Alternative service? Many of them are already gainfully employed, paying taxes. Come on, there are programs where you can get forgiveness of loans. If you're a doctor and you work in a distressed area, or if you are a teacher and you go into areas that are underserved with teachers, and that's what should be done. But ultimately, I think everybody is dodging the ultimate question. Why are tuitions so high? Tuitions are high because the states and the federal government are not paying enough of the operating costs of the universities and the technical colleges. When I was at UW-Madison in the early 70s, the tuition was $250 a semester. And that's because the state and the federal government paid 47% of the operating costs. Now they pay about 17%. University of Colorado, they pay 5%. They're essentially quasi-privatizing these universities, and they have to pay more tuition. So step it up. Step up aid to higher education and stop the for-profits from calling themselves universities, number one. Number two, naming themselves after states, which is deceptive. And then number three, getting federal, their students get federal loans. No federal loans for for-profits. They cannot use state names and they can't call themselves universities. That will, and then increase the subsidies to the states and the states themselves for operating costs. That will bring the tuitions down. We're going to the lines. David of Mequon, my friend. Thanks for calling. What's your mind today, David?
Hey, good morning, Matt. Thanks for taking my call. Really quickly, I just want to point out there was an article from Tom Berger. It was actually, let's see here. It was from December 3rd of 2020. And it kind of connects the dots as to how we got to this whole student loan explosion. And if you remember, and in the article, what it talks about, back in 2010, when we had budget reconciliation for the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare, student loans were put into that budget reconciliation act because the ability of eliminating the middleman, as Obama would say, was that the federal government took over the student loans. So where private banks were no longer able to do that kind of work. And in the process, in the article, it also talks about that after, I think it was like July 1st in 2014, there was a reduction as far as like repayments and all the other stuff. And consequently, the thing that was really telling in the article was, obviously when you take a mortgage on a house, you have certain rules that you have to, or at least the bank has to, the mortgage company, has to take an approach, ability to pay rules. And with the student loan end of things, there is no evaluation of creditworthiness of the borrower or their ability to pay. That's currently what it is right now. So,
okay, well, David, I want to respond before we go to it, because there are two things you said. One is, I believe banks still are making loans, and frankly, there is locked in a high percentage rate that can't be renegotiated. That's got to change. That's got to change. Students are being victimized on that. But secondly, when you're talking about credit worthiness, remember something. Beethoven came from a very, very poor background. So did one of the greatest mathematicians in history, a guy named Gauss in Germany. And so did a guy in Belfast named Stuart Bell. And these people came from very humble backgrounds. If they had walked in for a loan, and there weren't loans back then, Beethoven, Bell, and Gauss would have been denied loans under your theory. And that's ridiculous. In other words, this is human capital. Education is human capital. You're educating human beings. And that is the benefit to our society and the benefit to them. Luke, you're at the microphone, my friend. Luke is a co-host and co-host Dueling Tangents. What's your opinion on this, Luke?
I think that's just an interesting, like, you're asking 18-year-olds to be able to provide credit when they don't have, like, in David's, I don't know, hypothetical way to address this problem is you're going to ask 18-year-olds to start giving their credit scores before being able to take out the loans, which you're already tying your name to it. And you normally have a cosigner from a parent, or there are many different aspects of a student loan that gets signed up in various ways. But you're told, everybody in my generation, I'm the end of the millennial generation. Everybody in my generation was told you need to go to college. You need to go to college to get a good job. That was what was told to us. And so you take out loans, and in some practices, they're very predatory. Not everybody. I went to a very well-off high school, and guidance counselors were giving us step-by-step instructions how to do this. But that's not the case for a lot of kids 18 years old getting out of high school to go into these loans. And if you're telling me that you need to provide this credit check or whatever for the mortgage credit, that's only new. That's only since the entire economy burst on the bubble of the housing crisis in 2008. So yes, there are ways that we can change how these loans are administered, but acting like the step taken yesterday, because that's all it was. It's not a final solution to address the surmounting student loan crisis. $1.6 trillion in student loans are being financed on the backs of people trying to get ahead. They're trying to educate themselves, and it's ridiculous to believe that you're like, all of a sudden, you need to be able to prove. You're like you said, Matt, it's human capital. You're investing in yourself. You don't know what job you're going to land and how much money you're going to make outside of college, but we're told that we need to go and have a better education and get that education, and then you get people screaming and pulling their hair out because some relief was provided yesterday by the Biden administration. It baffles me a little bit, Matt.
Yeah. No, that's excellent comments. And David, I think that's a good response. In other words, and this is for somebody who is a lot younger than we are and on the firing line. And that's right. How many 18-year-olds, unless it's Bill Gates' son, and he has a copy of Bill Gates' will, how many 18? When I was 18, I went off to college when I was 17, but you know, I'm going to go in, they're going to say, what's your credit rate? And I'm going to go, well, I've had part-time jobs for a couple of summers. And
that doesn't get you a credit rating either, though. You got to have a credit card and everything to get credit rating. So most 18-year-olds right. aren't coming out of high school with a credit rating.
Yeah, right. I just don't. Exactly.
And Matt, I can tell you that $250 was not the price of tuition when I was in school. That maybe might have covered one of the textbooks that I was told I had to purchase. So that's what I had to pay for a textbook, not for a semester course.
Right. And what it comes down to, David, too, is, I mean, that's excellent testimony from a guy who is much more recently involved in it, which is Luke. But there's also the question is, why are the tuitions so high anyway? And that is because these public universities have less and less of their operating costs covered by the state and the federal government. And what do they do in Wisconsin? They pass the manufacturer's tax exemption. They should have put that money into higher education, quite frankly. We should pay more and bring the tuitions down that way. David, I always enjoy your calls. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. Luke, excellent comments. I want to go down to Uvalde, Pete Arredondo, the miserable excuse for a police chief in the Uvalde School District, was fired last night. School board met, private session. Remember, at Uvalde, there are about 380 officers in the hallways, and a sadistic murderer was in a classroom of fourth graders, and he murdered 19 little ones, and two teachers. And he was in there 77 minutes while 380 officers were outside. And the door was unlocked. Arredondo, they falsely said, well, I didn't have the keys. I got a giant baloney. Open the door. Finally, somebody came from the Border Patrol, yanked open the door and gunned the guy down. If that had happened a lot earlier, a lot of those 19 little ones and the teachers would have been spared. Now, he should have been fired in July. They had a meeting set in July. But Arredondo's lawyers said it was against his constitutional rights. What, against his constitutional rights to be a coward? He has, people were yelling coward at him, coward, coward, cobarde. That's what they're yelling at him, a coward. He was out there. And you know who they did arrest? They arrested parents who tried to get in, and they handcuffed them, threw them on the ground. We secured the area, sir. We arrested the parents. The sadistic murderers in there gunning down 19 little ones and two teachers, but we've done our job. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. This is pathetic. Pathetic. Finally, school board met, and they fired him. He's going to sue. For what? He should slink off like a cur with his tail between his legs. He didn't show up at the meeting. They wanted to talk to him, hear his side of the story. You know what he said? He said, I didn't show up at the meeting because I don't feel safe. Well, I agree. And he's the police chief. If the police chief doesn't feel safe, that's because you have a bad police chief. In any event, he was fired. He's very fortunate he wasn't criminally charged. You know, when 19 little ones are shot and murdered, just blown apart by an AR-15 and two teachers, and they're all buried and there are a series of funerals, beautiful little kids. And when they're all shot and this clown is out prancing around the hall in his uniform and arresting parents, the clown could have, they should have convened a grand jury. There's certain breaches of duty that resulting in murder like that should be actionable criminally. They didn't do that, and they didn't fire anybody else. Why not? There were 380 officers out there. What good are they? Chicken hawks. Chicken hawks. They're going to fire the chief chicken hawk, Pete Arredondo, and then they figure, okay, well, that takes care of that. That doesn't take care of anything. Where's the governor in this, Abbott? Where are the other police officials in the state? They keep their heads down. Keep their heads down. And the sad thing is, this is not indicative of police in general. Police in Wisconsin would not have acted that way. Most police officers wouldn't have acted that way. I had an uncle who was a police officer in New York City. I had a cousin who was a police officer in Connecticut. They wouldn't have acted that way. The guy's in there, and he's in there with a gun. What you do is you open it, and you have people crawl with their weapons on the floor. Somebody yanks open the door and they gun him down. The protocol number one is take out the gunman. And Arredondo said, well, we contained him. Yeah, you contained him in a classroom of fourth graders and two teachers. That's where you contained him for 77 minutes. Well, we contained him. We got the other people out. Oh, great. Okay. The other people weren't endangered because he was in there murdering people. Very simple. You have one guy stand and suddenly yank open the door. You have two marksmen on their bellies with their guns, and you blow him apart. And that is what the Border Patrol guys who finally came did. He was fired, didn't attend the meeting. People were shouting, coward, coward. The clown should get out of law enforcement. He's lucky. He is very lucky that he was not criminally charged. Very lucky there was not a grand jury to sniff him out. You can't have people like that in law enforcement. You cannot have people like that in law enforcement. Well, the development in the Pennsylvania Senate race between Fetterman, our guy, John Fetterman, and Mehmet Oz, who is truly bad news. Mehmet Oz, TV personality. He's the guy that Fetterman fingered in an ad. He fingered him in an ad. Oz thought it was a good idea, funny idea, to go through a supermarket and pretend like he ever shops in a supermarket and go, well, the price of crudité has gone up. Crudité is a French word meaning a vegetable selection. Pruitt's hay has gone up. So Fetterman had an ad, and he's holding a veggie plate, and he goes, in Pennsylvania, we call it a veggie plate. The thing about Mehmet Oz, just so you know, Mehmet Oz is joint citizenship with Turkey. He was born in the United States. His parents are Turkish. And he served in the Turkish military. He votes in Turkey. He didn't vote in the United States, and he didn't serve in our military. That was wrong. Why? This is the Ottoman military. The Ottoman military that spent 1,000 years invading Europe. Hey, guy, you want to run in Pennsylvania?
Sitting in the morning sun. I'll be sitting when the evening comes.
Welcome back to Matt Flynn Direct. Lines are open, 844-967-2789. Before we go to the lines, I'm going to finish up with Mehmet Oz. Fortunately, Fetterman's way ahead of him in the polls, but Oz got stung on the vegetable thing. Stung on the vegetable thing, calling him crudité. So he comes back, and here's what he says. He says, Fetterman had ever eaten a vegetable, he wouldn't have had a major stroke and wouldn't be in the position of having to lie about it continually. Well, that's pretty sad. I mean, he hits the guy for having a stroke. Fetterman's a great guy. He's not lying about anything. Doctors all around Pennsylvania said to Oz, come on, guy, get out of here. Shut up. You don't insult the guy like that. But this Mehmet Oz is no good, and we can't have him in the Senate. We're going to the lines. I'm going to take you in order, starting with Mark of the Sack, my friend. Thanks for calling Western Monday, Mark of the Sack.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad to hear that guy down in Racine County that committed the voter fraud is, you know, the Justice Department look at it. But I'm wondering if the Racine County Sheriff, that apparently has been a supporter, is an accessory before or after the fact, because if this guy told that sheriff he was going to do this prior to him doing it, then he was aware of a crime being committed, and after the fact, he knew about the crime and didn't do anything about it, that he's one of these Trumpists that, you know, talks about voter fraud, and him, he actually apparently approves of this voter fraud because it proves their point that voter fraud can occur, but that any kind of fraud can occur. That if well planned and not because, but it just doesn't happen because most people are unwilling to take the consequences if they get caught for that voter fraud, and that it just is. Can this guy be trusted to officiate, do his duties officially anymore? I mean, I wouldn't trust him pulling me over on the side of the road, because if he saw a liberal bumper sticker on my car, who knows if he's going to, you know, go off on somebody. These constitutional sheriffs are pretty scary, that apparently in some cases they've actually, you know, supported some pretty bad folks. And
right.
That their first loyalty is supposed to be to the law. It's not supposed to be to some cockamamie, half-assed notion that that the sheriff is more powerful than the president of the United States.
Right, you're hitting the nail on the head. The sheriff is a guy named Schmeling, and he's the guy that Harry Waite talked to. And I had never thought about it, but you're right. The DOJ should also subpoena Schmeling to find out if he knew about it in advance, or did Waite go to him afterwards. But if he cooked this up with Waite at all, then he's part of it. And that was a crime. That's conspiracy to commit a crime. So, and he is a member of the Constitutional Sheriffs. He's in the Constitutional Sheriff Association is 300 of the, there are 3,000 sheriffs in the United States. 300 of them, 10% belong to this. They believe that the power resides in the county, and the sheriff is the most powerful individual in the county, more than the president of the United States. Power of the county in Latin is called posse comitatus. And frankly, we want law enforcement, good law enforcement, that follows civilian orders and civilian control and doesn't freelance and doesn't do this kind of stuff. So I would urge, and Mark, you're the one that put the idea in, and I think it's a good idea, inquire of Harry Waite and inquire of Schmeling, did you discuss this before he did it? And did you assist him in doing it or advise him or know about it or talk about it? And if you did, that's part of a conspiracy to commit election fraud. So we'd say convene a grand jury and look at it. I don't expect that this is going to happen before November, but at some point this has got to happen. You cannot have people going around the state asking for other folks with fraudulent information, other folks' election ballots. Thanks for calling, Mark. Paul, Wisco Paul, my friend. Thanks for calling Western Monday, Wisco Paul.
Good morning, Matt. Thanks for taking my call. I'll make this quick. Biden did do the right thing on the student loan debt, helping out people that need help. God, if it was for the Republicans, they don't even want Social Security, for goodness sakes. But I want to give a shout-out to the UW nurses who want their union back. Walker took it away with Act 10. The people down at the UW Hospital, which is a great place, saved my life at one point. And if I have to, I'll walk a picket line with those men and women. They're just wonderful, wonderful people, and it's a great institution down there. So shout out for the UW nurses. I hope you win. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, Wisco Paul. Yeah, and thank you for all your calls and standing tall for labor and standing tall for working people. That's what this station is all about. We have a couple more topics we can get to, at least one before we end the show. There was a fascinating poll. You know, a lot of folks go around, they go, Liz Cheney should run for president in 2024. Liz Cheney should run for president in 2024. I do not think she should. I think very highly of her. I think that she has spine. She stands for, and she has integrity. And God bless her and thank her and Adam Kinzinger for standing tall. And I've suggested that Joe Biden, if Merrick Garland doesn't get off the dime after the election, and may want to make her attorney general. But here's what the poll said. It was 1,563 people, U.S. adults. That's a pretty good poll around the country. In a three-way race in 2024, right now, there's a snapshot in the polls. She takes votes almost exclusively from Biden. In a three-way race, Trump gets 40% of the vote, Biden gets 32% of the vote, and Cheney gets 11% of the vote. In a two-way race, Biden eases out Trump by a couple of points. Now, remember something about Liz Cheney. She has tremendous integrity. I think very highly of her, but she also voted 93% of the time with Trump. She opposed the $1.5 trillion Infrastructure Act. She voted against extending the Voting Rights Act. She voted against Obamacare expansion, and she voted against the ability of the government to negotiate lower drug prices in bulk from pharmaceutical companies. She's a conservative. I respect her personally, but I really don't want to see her because she will take votes away from Biden. The other thing I'll say is, why is Trump at 40% of the vote in any event? And that is because one of the prior callers, I think it was Randy of Madison, pointed out that all Trump cares about is publicity, getting his name in the news. There's an old saying in politics, I don't care what you write about me as long as you spell my name right. And, you know, this has all been terrible for Trump. Steals nuclear secrets, you know, the January 6th insurrection. But through it all, he has his core loyal supporters. And the problem is people tend to vote for names that they understand and remember, names that they understand. And his name is in the paper as much as Joe Biden's. It really is every day. That is his purpose. Deny him oxygen. Don't cover him as much as possible. Okay, thanks for all the calls. We're coming to the end of the show. Great show. It was great call-ins as always. Matt Flynn Direct will be back same time, same place tomorrow. I'm signing off for today. Ooh, I'm sitting on a darker